This morning, we're very fortunate to have Chris with us, one of the chaplains from the Mustard Seed Church. And if I've had the privilege a number of times of being able to go to the Mustard Seed Church and see Chris and his colleagues at work, and I'm always amazed at the compassion and the humility with which they work with Edmonton's downtown citizens. And we're very fortunate to have Chris preach to us this morning. And he even shared a fact that his friends have all gone out to the Grand Prix races, and he's here preaching to us today, so we know he has his priorities straight. So thank you, Chris, for being with us this morning.
Good morning. I'll tell you, first off, I've got a bottle of water here, and I have a feeling I'll probably go through it between now and when I'm done. This is the first time I've ever spoke with robes on, and I picked a nice day to do it. It is. So I got my water here, so I'm hoping to make it through the sermon without passing out or anything. But I was like, wow, it's warm in these things. So I have a new appreciation for Southern Baptist preachers in the southern U.S. who wear these all the time and do it in 100-degree weather. As Debbie was saying, I've been down the Mustard Seed for 8 years now, I think I've been down there. And so I kind of feel like an adjunct member of your church in some ways. I've met a lot of you. I've worked closely with a lot of you. I actually come to your church every second week, but most of you don't know it because I come on Saturday night, so it's rather empty. But I have a ministry, actually, that takes place in your church here. And it's part of what I do. I'm the correctional chaplain at Mustard Seed, and I work with federal inmates who are coming back to our communities. And so I try to build bridges between the community and the prison system, the community, the churches. And so I try to build this big network. And we have a group that meets here that's a group of volunteers, and some federal inmates, some guys who just got out of prison, some have been out for a long time. And we meet at your church every second week. So I kind of feel at home here because we're here every second Saturday night having a good time and really enjoying the hospitality, although there's usually none of you here. But it's very hospitable while we're here. And we really do enjoy it. And we've been so grateful because we're coming on 2.5 years that we've been meeting at your church doing this. And we've had some amazing experiences with these guys that we're working with that are coming back to our communities. And so we've been very grateful that you guys have just been gracious hosts and allowed us to be here every second week. And so we first off need to thank you for that. Today I think I'm going to start talking a little bit about my daughter. It's a good place to start on this because I got a 3-year-old daughter, which is just a wonderful age for me. I just have such a blast with her because of where her mind is and what she says and how she thinks. And she's very honest. 3-year-olds are quite honest, which I do appreciate sometimes. And my wife is expecting another baby, and my daughter has been asking me when my baby will be born. So I'm not sure about the honesty part with her, but looking at me going, Daddy, when's your baby due? I'm like, I'm not having one, but I know it looks like it, but I'm not having a baby, dear. Mommy's having a baby. Well, you look like you're having a baby. And I'm like, Daddy's going to the gym tomorrow morning, and it's not going to look like that for long. But we were at the park one day, I don't know, a week and a half ago, and it was 31, 32 out, and we're at the water park out in St. Albert, just enjoying an evening with my family and hanging out with my daughter. And she got her, grandma bought her a nice drumstick, and so she comes marching over with her drumstick, and I'm just sitting there with a bottle of water. I go, that's a nice looking drumstick you have there. Ice cream sounds really good. And I just looked at her and said, do you love Daddy? And she looked at me and said, no, because you don't have ice cream. So I looked at her and said, well, does Daddy love you? Well, yes, because I have the ice cream. And she walked away. And it got me thinking about, you only have to spend a little bit of time with a group of toddlers to realize that it starts early, this whole idea of sinful nature. It starts rather young. You know, you watch a group of 2- and 3-year-olds go around together and play together and talk to each other, and you can see it taking place. You can see this idea of the lying and the clicks. And my 3-year-old, she doesn't really understand lying, but she's learning how to do it, and we're having to call her on it, we can ask her things, and somebody else had done it, Who dumped over the toys? Oh, Kenzie did, and that's her best friend. And her best friend hasn't been around for 3 days. And it's like, oh, Kenzie did, and she walks out the room. And we're kind of like, hold on, Brooklyn. I don't think Mackenzie's the one that dumped out your toys. And so I was reflecting on this as I've been reading back into 2 Samuel again. And I started reading David's life again about 2 weeks ago. And David is probably, for me, one of the most intriguing characters in the Bible altogether, he has such an intriguing life. And so I'm going to talk today a bit about his life and just take a bit of a different spin on it and look at a few different aspects of it. But I think one of the things that I fully appreciate about David is his humanity. I like David's flaws. It makes me feel better when I read about his screw-ups, I guess. It kind of goes, okay, if David can, you know, screw up that bad, I'm doing okay. And so I've been following his journey, and he is a man that is really, I'd probably say in some ways, like if you actually read 2 Samuel and 1 Samuel and his life and then read the Psalms, you kind of get a picture of a guy who may be manic depressive, may need to be medicated, but he's up and down and he's all over the place. I mean, he is flawed, he has these problems, and then in the next sentence you hear, you know, here's a man with a heart after God. Here's a man who seeks after God with his whole heart. And you kind of get stumped because then you read this other stuff that he's doing and go, well, where's this man that I read about that seeks after God? And at one point, the nation of Israel actually referred to God as the God of David. They were that closely related in the people's eyes that David had that intimate of a relationship with God. And so they looked at him and they called it, you know, that's the God of David because our king has that close of a relationship with him. But then you read other passages. You read about his temper. You know, at one point in his life, when he's out on the run, kind of, he has this incident with Nabal and Abigail. I'm not going to get into it, but he feels disrespected. And his answer to feeling disrespected is to get 200 men of swords to go down and kill every male in the household. And if you kind of step back from that, if you just read over it and kind of go, oh yeah, but if you step back and think about that, simply because you were disrespected, you were going to go kill. We have no idea how many males were in this household, but we're going to assume there's at least 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of them. And his reaction was, I'm going to go kill him because you disrespected me. That's a pretty extreme reaction, if you ask me. And it wasn't until Abigail comes and confronts him and kind of mellows him out and calms him down that he stops that plan and stops him from sinning. And actually, she's the wise one in the whole story because she says, I don't want the blood on your head because you're a man of God. You don't need the blood on your head. But his first reaction was, you know what? I'm going to go kill him. You disrespect me. You're going to die. And then look at his parenting skills or kind of lack thereof. And we know that David, we have no idea how many kids David had. But I'm assuming with the number of wives and the concubines and all that, that he had a fair number of children. And I'd probably call him, I don't know, an absent father, maybe. I don't think he spent a lot of time with his kids. You can read through there. You find one point where one of his sons rapes his daughter, so another son comes and kills that son. And I went, wow, that's a dysfunctional family. David, maybe you want to spend some time with your kids. You know, you might want to get to know them better and be a better role model because things aren't going well in your family. And yet he has this relationship with God. And so that's where you meet this man who is that, just that, a man. He has his flaws. He has his dysfunctions. He has his problems. And yet somewhere in the middle of that, he's still seeking after God. In the midst of all the chaos of his life, he still wants to reach out to God. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the famous, the most infamous, the David and Bathsheba story. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. I mean, that's the most infamous. That is like the tabloid headlines of his time, is the king sleeps with this woman, sets her husband up and has him killed. And the story is fairly well known, so I won't get into it, but I want to take a spin on it. I want to look at it a little bit differently than what most people take, I guess the perspective they take. And when you read it, I guess the first people will say, well, look at, you know, oh, David had a lust problem. You know, that's really what got him into trouble, is he really struggled with lust. And I would probably argue with people on that one. I don't think lust was David's issue. If he is simply out for lust, the guy had, I mean, 30, 40, 50 concubines. He had wives. And I'm pretty sure most of them were really good looking. I mean, he was the king, right? So I'm thinking lust isn't his problem. He's got all these women that are there. I think there's something deeper that David is going after. And this is just my own speculation, so I probably wouldn't write it down and take notes on this. So, but my speculation is there something deeper? There's a deeper issue David was seeking after. And I'm just going to postulate here. It could have been, you know, David had all these people, but he had no sense of intimacy with anybody. And for those of you who are married, you can understand that sense of intimacy that you have with that one spouse that you share everything with. And I kind of thought, well, how did David get that with 30 spouses and 50 concubines? And yet it's a craving that each of us have. We have that desire to have that intimacy. And not just in a physical way, but emotional intimacy, a relational intimacy. So I was kind of wondering, well, I wonder if that's what he was pursuing after, that he thought maybe with this one girl I could reach that point, I could share that intimacy, and we could have that relationship that I'm so desperately needing. It could have been, self-esteem issues are another one. Maybe David struggled with self-esteem, and he built self-esteem through the conquering of females, through being able to say, I've got another one. I got another one in my group now. But I'm not sure. Like I said, I don't know what it was for sure, but I think it was definitely more than lust. Just because when I look at his life, I go, you have all these women, so lust isn't necessarily an issue. You have an outlet for that side of your life. But what is it you're seeking? And I'm going to break it down and talk a little bit about sin here, because I think sin has two parts to it. You have the what I've called the overt, which is the action. That would be the lie you told for David. It's the fact that he got into an adulterous affair. And then you have the covert. And that's the underlying need that you're trying to meet in that sin. What is it you're trying to meet? Or what are you afraid of? When I was doing my internship at the Royal Alec Hospital, I had a supervisor who said, the redemption of sin comes in us understanding why we do it. Why is it? Why do you need to lie about what you do for work? Is it a fear of being known? Is it a fear that people will judge you? Why is it we gossip? Do we need to build ourselves up and take people down? What is it we're trying to do inside? Because there's more than just the action going on. There's something deeper going on. In the work I do, in the prisons here in Alberta, in the federal prisons, my guess is about 90% of the people I interact with, and I'm talking about inmates here, not just the staff, but the inmates and the guys that I'm working with, I'd say 90% of them, the act they committed is completely related to something going on deeper inside of them. That there's something that they are expressing, whether that's through their anger, through their violence, through their dysfunctions, through their addictions. There's always something that seems as lying deeper. And for a lot of them, it's dealing with lifelong hurts, lifelong pain. When I sit down and I spend time with these guys, and I sit down with one, I say, okay, well, share your story with me. Let me understand your story. Tell me where you're from. Tell me what your life has been like. I can tell you, most of the time, it is not pretty. I don't meet too many guys in prison that say they came from a loving, functional family, grew up in a good home, grew up going to school, all that stuff. More often than not, I meet somebody who has a life of pain, who's experienced violence at a very early age, who's experienced dysfunction. And so we travel down those roads, and at times it can be pretty brutal to hear, because you're sitting with a person. Yeah, they've committed an offense, and I never want to say that this is to justify what they've done or that they can use their past as an excuse. But what it is it's a place for us to start to understand. And I usually want to take them back there so we can start to figure out where did things start going wrong. Because we can't fix anything if we don't know where they first got broken. And so often, it is a painful, painful journey. And I have to sit there and listen as somebody describes just the abuse that they went through. And so then I'm confronted. I'm sitting there and I'm talking to a person who's an offender, who has committed a horrendous crime, but is often a victim as well. So I have to figure out who I'm talking to. Am I talking to a victim of crime, or am I talking to somebody who's committed crime? And so often it is one and the same. It is a person who's experienced dark things, who's experienced pain beyond anything I could imagine, and is then lashed out in that, in one way or another. And so it can be a dark journey, because often in these conversations I have with them, we end up in the dark places. Places that have given birth to violence, places that have given birth to evil, to things that no movie could portray what we are capable of the way we treat each other. And I need to walk down these roads with these guys. And as I do so, I think one of the things that I come in contact with when I walk down these roads, when I hear these stories, when I walk with them through these dark places, is I often find myself I have to bump into my own stuff. You see, when you go with somebody to a dark place, often you can be taken to your own dark places. And I think it's when we realize that all of us carry those dark places that we can start to heal from them, to know that they're there. And I'll give you an example of this. I was down at Bowdoin Institution, which is a medium security facility. And I spent a couple hours just chatting with a guy, and I'll call him John. Most of the guys I'll talk to you about today, I'll just call John. It's easy that way just to keep their name out of it. And John was telling me what it was like to be 18 years old and be sentenced to a life sentence at a federal prison. And as we were chatting, I asked him to tell me, what did you do? What was your crime? Take me down that street. Take me on that journey with you. And he told me about a young guy who was a bit, I mean, he wasn't a huge troublemaker. He had never done jail time or anything serious, and, you know, kind of a wild teenager, but got out of control at a party one night. A lot of drinking going on, a lot of alcohol, a lot of partying. Fight breaks out. He beats the guy up, doesn't realize how bad, and he killed the guy that night. And he's now 18 years facing a life sentence for murder. And I had to stop in my tracks because I go to my own dark place and go, you know what? I've been there. I've been to the bar. I've been drinking. I had this misguided youth, and I can remember getting into a bar fight, you know, numerous times. I thought, wow, how quickly, in a split second, could I be doing a life sentence for murder? And automatically, my heart went out to him because I thought, wow, at 18, your life is going to be stripped from you for the next 15 to 20, 25 years because of one night. And it's not just, I made sure to put this, it's not a gender thing. I've spent some time with a young 21-year-old girl who's out in our West End in a female prison out here, who's 21, has never done a day of prison in her life, has never been convicted of a sentence, has never done anything, and the same thing happened. She and her friends were out partying, something went wrong, fights breaks out, and she's doing 10 years on a manslaughter. 21. She had a job, graduated from high school, was looking forward to going on and doing something with her life, and she spent the next 10 years in a federal prison. And it made me stop and think, oh, you know what? I have that capability. There's a dark place in me that, given the right circumstances in my life, given the right environment, I could be capable of some pretty horrendous acts. I think as I went down that journey, it also made me feel more human. Because I realized that these people who are in our prison systems, who have done these things, aren't from another planet. They're not some whole different breed. They're people like you and I. They're people. They're human. They carry the emotions. They carry the feelings. They carry the pain. And how they've lashed out is wrong, but they're still human. And they're flawed. We're all flawed. This is where I kind of sit with David for a while and meet a flawed person. When I read of his life, I think here's a person who's got a heart after God, but he's still human. He still has the ability to be ticked off to the point that he wants to kill somebody. He still struggles with lust. He still struggles with loneliness. Struggles with being a parent. What does that mean to be a parent? And yet, in the midst of all of this, he still has a heart for God. And so for me, that makes him human. It makes him easy to touch, easy to feel, easy to read, because, you know what, he's human. He doesn't have this wonderful life, you know? I mean, his life is filled with pain. When you read through it and read what his life is like, there is a lot of pain that this man carries. And I think this is one of the greatest paradoxes of our Christian faith. Is this whole idea of how we give ourselves to Christ, how we say, God, give me your Holy Spirit, fill me up, you know, make me like you. And then we go to the door and we do some dumb decision. You know, we go, we tell this lie that we thought, oh, I'd never lie to them again. You know, oh, I thought I was done with that, you know, my struggle with lust or my struggle with pride. God, I thought you were filling me with your Holy Spirit. And yet I'm still struggling here. And for me, it's one of these it's a tension and it's a paradox we sit in. You know, Paul talks about us being new creations, that we are new creations in Christ. And yet so many of us stumble across old habits and old sins. And part of that I have chalked up to the fact that we are human, that inherently we are flawed from the beginning. That from the beginning of our lives, it starts to form and take shape, and that we are imperfect. There's a guy that I knew on the streets many years ago. I think we're coming on to the fifth year of his death now. But he was an Aboriginal fellow who did a lot of time in a federal prison, and his desire was to go to Bible college when he got out. Very profound faith, very strong faith. And he wanted to go and be a part of a church, be part of a Bible college and become educated and go on to other things. He thought, you know, he could really be a minister. He had all these ideas that he wanted to do. And I'll call him Johnny. Johnny struggled. He had a lot of abuse in his background, a lot of physical, all types of abuse. And then he got himself messed up into drugs and alcohol and then prison and all these things. So his life had not gone smoothly to this point. But he had made a turn in prison, and he so wanted to go and do this and be a student and learn at the Bible colleges and go on and go into ministry. And yet, he struggled with the fact that he couldn't find a place to be accepted. When he went to white churches, he felt out of place and felt like they didn't accept him because he was an Aboriginal. Then when he went to Aboriginal churches, they didn't accept him because they called him an apple. I don't know if anybody here has heard that term, but it's often a derogatory term used to describe from one native to another, that they're red on the outside, white on the in. And so even his own people didn't really accept him because they saw him trying to become what they thought was a white person. And so he struggled in all this. He struggled and he struggled. And 5 years ago, he died of a heroin overdose. And that is the one thing he couldn't beat. And yet you met a man, when you met him on the streets or you talked to him after he got out of prison, he was a man of a profound faith in God and in Christ. And yet this is the way his life ended. And it just reminded me again that we are human. That part of our faith is the fact that we are flawed and we are human. That there's something broken in us from the beginning. That all of us have a dark place in us. And here in Canada, you know, we can often conceal our darknesses and find appropriate ways to deal with them and not touch them. But if you look through history and look around the world and you find Christians are quite capable of some pretty horrendous things. In 1925, a census was done in Germany. Germany in 1925 consisted of 40 million Protestants, 21 million Catholics, and 620,000 other denominations. And yet a Holocaust took place there. In the mid-1990s, you had Christians killing Christians in Rwanda. And these are people who attended churches on Sundays, who worshipped, who came together to do Bible studies and that. And yet somewhere along the line, they're still capable of doing this to other people. It just reminded me that we are flawed. And David was no different in his life. He struggled with his sinfulness. He struggled with his dysfunctionality. He struggled with his wounds, with his brokenness, with his relational difficulties. And yet he still had a heart after God. He pursued after God. In the midst of his own chaos and his own dysfunctions, his heart still wanted to pursue after God. And I think this is where we meet God. We meet him in our dark places. Jesus said he came for the sick, not the healthy. He came not to be a doctor for those who think they're healthy, but for those of us who know we're sick, for those of us who know that we have a dark spot, who know that we're capable of some pretty bad things. Being flawed is part of being human. And in some cases, it's exactly what makes us human, is the fact that we are flawed, is that we do have these tendencies, that we do have a sinful nature. That is part of our humanity. And it's in the messes of our lives, in our brokenness, in our dark places, that God often begins to work. And the best story I have for this out of the work I do, I often end up in some fairly bizarre situations because I work with a population that is quite different and the conversations can be quite different. But I was out for breakfast one morning and I meet guys who have been released from prison, and we meet once a week, and we get together and we talk, and I try to make sure things are going well and help them make that adjustment. But one morning, there's a convicted sex offender that I've been working with for, I think, coming on 5 years. And we get together usually once or twice a week and just check up, have breakfast. So we thought we'd have breakfast this one morning. And we had a lady come and join us. And she is studying to be a chaplain. And this lady has been through, she's a survivor of sexual abuse, of physical abuse, of emotional abuse. She's been divorced. A lot of things, a lot of pain in her life. And so I sat there that morning and I listened to the two of these people talk and share. And both of them shared about where God was working in their lives. And it just amazed me as I sit there, I was listening to a victim and an offender, and I was listening to both people who have been broken and have all sorts of pain in their lives. And yet they could tell you where God was working in their lives. They could tell you where God was, and that God was present in their messes, that God was present in their darkness. And there's one lady who was there. She's telling me a bit. She's an artist too, and I can be honest and say I'm not the most best critic of art or the lover of the arts. And so she was just telling me about some of the artwork. I thought, oh, that's kind of nice. Until she told me about one piece that she's done. And she made out of, I'm going to say it's ceramic, but it could be a different substance. And she just made a globe, and it's round. And she said, and she made it perfectly round and perfectly smooth. And then she just took a little ball-peen hammer and hit it on the top, so the whole thing cracked. And after it cracked, she went and she drilled the bottom out, and she stuck a light bulb in. And it now sits on a shelf, and you can turn it on. And when you turn it on, the light emanates from all the cracks in the globe. And she just said, that's my relationship with God. This is my symbol of my relationship with God, is that through all my cracks and all my brokenness, that's where he glows. That's where his light comes through. And it left me almost wanting to cry at this breakfast table with the two of them. I was like, wow, that is just powerful. And so I come back to the fact that we are flawed, but that is God's specialty. That is where God works, is in the messes. God comes to work in the darkness. You know, one of the things that brought me to the mustard seed 8 years ago is I needed to know that God worked in the dark places, that he wasn't just in churches, but I needed to know that God was on the streets, in the alleys, in the prisons. Because the God I believed in needed to be down there for me to continue to believe in him. And I can tell you in 8 years, I have met him over and over and over again, working in the inner cities, in the prisons, in those dark places that we so often don't want to go to, but God is at work there. And so it is in our messes, it is in our brokenness that we find ourselves being flawed, that we find ourselves sometimes being lost, sometimes lashing out. And yet, given the opportunity, that is where God will begin to work in our lives. Then I just want to close in prayer now, and we'll go from there. Father, first off, I want to thank you for being the God of compassion, a God of mercy, the God who loves, who meets us in our dark places, who takes us on a journey of healing, Lord. And I thank you that your specialty is broken people, flawed people, people that can come to you and say, I am sick and I need a doctor. I am not well. There is darkness in me, Lord. And we thank you that that you reach out, that you bring us out of that darkness. And so I just pray as we go here from here this morning that you would begin to work in those here, in those dark corners of their lives, that they would begin to give them to you and allow you to begin the work in there. And so we thank you that is where we find you. We thank you that you reach for us in the places that we try and hide, and that you pursue after us. So I just pray for this day, I pray for this week, and ask that you continue to bless it and keep us, watch over us, and just allow us to learn how to not only deal in our own flaws, but to accept people with their flaws, and to know that you're at work in them too. I just pray these things in your name. Amen.